From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, Close Encounters. Happy birthday to Beth Racino of O'Fallon, Missouri, from your daughter Amanda, your son-in-law Kyle, and granddaughter Fiona. Hope you have a great birthday. Enjoy it to the fullest. Hope you all had a great weekend. Keep the good fight going. Here's what's happening. The United States is monitoring intelligence that North Korea's leader, Kim Jong-un, is in grave danger after surgery, according to a U.S. official with direct knowledge. Kim recently missed the celebration of his late grandfather's birthday on April 15th, which raised speculation about his well-being. He had been seen 4 days before that at a government meeting. Another U.S. official says that concerns about Kim's health are credible, but the severity is hard to determine at this time. We'll keep monitoring that story. In Canada, the death toll from the worst mass shooting in Canadian history rose to 19, including a police officer and the gunman. Canadian police said that, adding that they expected to uncover more fatalities from the weekend massacre in Nova Scotia. The gunman, who at one point masqueraded as a policeman, also disguised his car to look like a police cruiser, shattered the peace of rural communities in the Atlantic province during a 12-hour rampage that started late on Saturday. It's a horrible story. U.S. Supreme Court has ruled that the constitutional guarantee of trial by jury requires a unanimous verdict for serious crimes, siding with a Louisiana man convicted of murder and paving the way for potentially hundreds of defendants found guilty by divided juries to receive new trials. That's an amazing story. U.S. crude oil prices plunged to their lowest level in history as traders continued to fret over a slump in the demand due to the coronavirus pandemic. The price of the nearest oil futures contract, which expires Tuesday, was the hardest hit, detaching from later this month futures contracts with a drop-off of more than 50%. This suggests that some believe that there could be a recovery later in the year. I sure would hope so. The United States, Mexico, and Canada are extending restrictions on non-essential travel for additional 30 days due to the coronavirus crisis, according to the Department of Homeland Security. Now, the Navy's top admiral will soon decide the fate of the ship captain who was fired after pleading for commanders to move faster to safeguard his coronavirus-infected crew on the USS Theodore Roosevelt. In a glare of a public spotlight, Admiral Mike Gilday will decide whether Navy Captain Brett Crozier stepped out of line when he went ahead and around his chain of command and sent an email pushing for action to stem the outbreak. As of Friday, 660 sailors on the aircraft now docked at Guam had tested positive for the virus. Seven were hospitalized. One sailor, who was found from Arkansas, has died, and more than 4,000 of the ship's 5,000 crew members have been moved onto the island for quarantine. I think he should get his post back. We shall see. Well, the coronavirus confining billions of people to their homes. Internet usage around the world has witnessed a sharp spike. Social distancing has called for new ways to connect with friends and relatives, mostly through video chat. Streaming services like Amazon and Netflix have reported all-time highs in viewing traffic, and more patients and healthcare professionals are turning to telemedicine for health consultations. However, in some parts of the world, citizens are compelled to battle the pandemic without the internet, its entertainment, and more importantly, its ability of hitting and reaching vital health information. Let's check in with Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Well, it sure is being used a lot, Lauren. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, and in some parts of the world, this isn't new. Countries that have comparatively limited internet infrastructures, especially where they have centralized control, have been imposing all kinds of internet shutdowns. Usually, this is for political reasons. They don't want their populations talking to people outside the country. They don't want them accessing information from outside the country that the leadership can't control. But in a situation like this, a global pandemic, this becomes a dramatic question of life and death, because people have to have ways to get to good information, and many of these countries are not good sources of accurate health information about something like this that's so new. And if people can't get good information on what they should be doing and what the appropriate health care activities are, and you know, all these kinds of obvious things that people would be looking for, it's going to put it puts people at risk. Now, there have actually been some lifting of some of these restrictions in a few cases, but most of them are still in place. I mean, luckily, something like this is much less practical to do for the United States, among other reasons, because a lot of those sources of accurate information are here to start with. So it's, you know, we're not in a situation where we're mainly looking outside the U.S. But we also have a much more decentralized internet system. There are certainly choke points that we've talked about in the past, but it's harder to visualize how you would shut down the internet here in the fashion that's done in these other countries, where really what they're trying to do is they're trying to isolate people there to only be able to use sources inside those countries. Also, in many countries around the world, the primary way that people access the internet is with their smartphones or their feature phones. And so that means that to shut off the internet, often that means also shutting down or limiting cellular service in various ways. And there's all kinds of obvious negative impacts to that as well.
And Lauren, when things get back to normal, are people going to be used to what they're doing right now? And that is social distancing, just using their smartphones, shopping online, not going to stores?
You know, there's no historical precedent for this, right? I mean, nothing like this has ever happened in the internet age, so it's difficult to you know, really know what's going to happen. My guess is that things will gradually get back to something approaching normal, but that normal will not be exactly like it was before, and it's probably going to take considerable time for that to happen. Certainly, we have seen where some of the limiting factors are in the internet. The internet has held up pretty well through all this, but one thing that's been happening that I've been noticing and that people have been mentioning to me is that people, for example, on cable systems who get their internet from cable are finding that their upstream speeds, their speeds back out,
much slower,
are slowing way, way down. And the reason for that is that those networks, those cable networks, were designed mostly for lots of data coming toward the users, to watch movies and look at web pages and things. It wasn't for a lot of data going out. And when you're doing video conferencing and video calls, it's much more of an equal amount of data, of equal amount of bandwidth in both directions. And the networks just weren't engineered for that. So there's going to be some interesting thinking going on as to how to deal with that if we assume, and it's very likely to happen, that video conferencing and similar systems like that are going to be seeing much more usage going forward.
Thanks for the comments. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Last Friday during Open Lines, I got a call from one of our listeners who said he saw a string of UFOs, didn't know what the heck it was. Then another caller called in and said it's Elon Musk's satellites. So we did some checking and found out, by the way, that now over Britain, over that area, they were spotting the UFO-like lights racing through the night sky. Aliens weren't to blame for the lights. Instead, the satellites are from Elon Musk's Starlink fleet. They form a constellation of thousands of satellites and are designed to provide low-cost broadband internet service from low Earth orbit. How about that? Speaking of things in the sky, let's check in with Dr. Sky, Stephen Cates. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George, and wow, you're right. The Starlink launch again will happen this week, George, with another cluster of 60 satellites, and they're kind of photobombing so many of the astronomers' photographs. But, George, we actually continue with space. The first manned launch to the International Space Station from the U.S. in some 10 years may happen around May the 27th, but this time not on a NASA rocket, but once again a SpaceX Falcon 9, topped off by this amazing Dragon capsule. And this is important. This will helpfully lower the launch per seat. Imagine, George, paying this about $21.3 million per seat back in 2006, and it's gone sky-high astronomical up to $82 million per seat in 2015. And that's because the U.S. has been depending, of course, on Russian rockets to get to space. On this historic launch, we'll see Air Force Colonel Bob Behnken and Marine Corps Colonel Doug Hurley moving up to the International Space Station. That hopeful launch takes place, as I mentioned, on May the 27th, 4:32 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time from the famous launch pad 39A. In astronomy, George, the demise of Comet Atlas, comet officially known as C2019Y4, it's moving on what we call a death dive toward the sun, just like you and I talked years ago. Remember Comet Ison? Similar thing. Some five fragments have broken off the nucleus of this comet. Comet Atlas was getting astronomers and everybody in the world who loves the sky excited because it was brightening, and unfortunately, it probably can't take the solar heat. But there's another comet, George, this comet known as Comet Swan, officially known as C2020F8. It'll be brightening, and I'll be updating everybody in weeks to come on that. We wrap it up with the live sky. George, tonight, tomorrow morning, and early Wednesday morning, these are the nights of the Lyrat meteor shower. Look high up into the northeast sky, probably now up until dawn, just above the bright star Vega. And if you're lucky and have dark skies with clear skies, you'll be able to see 10 to 15 of these shooting stars, an amazing beginning of a whole new series of meteor showers. Dr. Sky reminds everyone, simply always remember to keep your eyes to the skies. We recommend, of course, theskylive.com and wikisky.org. And George, it's amazing because this can be a nice remedy, don't you think, for COVID isolation, getting out in an open field, a patio or a balcony, and some fresh air. Take a look at this, ladies and gentlemen. I'm your navigator on the highway to the heavens, and I appreciate being here, George. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sky. We appreciate you. Up next, Dr. Michael Sala back with us. His latest work, Rise of the Red Dragon, Origins and the Threat of China's Secret Space Program. That's next. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Michael Sala, PhD, pioneer in the development of exopolitics. He's the author of a number of books exposing U.S. government policies and extraterrestrial life and exopolitics. His latest we will talk about in a second, Rise of the Red Dragon. Dr. Sala was an assistant professor in residence at the School of International Service at American University. He has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland in Australia. He's also the founder of the Exopolitics Institute, a not-for-profit organization that analyzes the political implications of extraterrestrial life. Michael, welcome back under these tense times, my friend. I hope you're doing well.
I'm doing well, George. Yes, I am getting out there and doing my exercise out in the water whenever I can.
I was in Denver this weekend taping our Beyond Belief television programs, and in my hotel room I was watching Ancient Aliens, and you were all over the place this weekend. It was cool to see you up there.
Right. Well, yeah, they came out here and did some filming around the Big Island, and I showed them some of the spots that are significant for the history here and the star visitor connection.
Super. As if we don't have enough to worry about with China with viruses, now we got to worry about their space program. Tell us what's going on there.
Oh, yes. Well, China is truly an enigma for a lot of people. People are trying to figure out what is going on in China. And I did actually travel to China in December of 2018 and got to see two of the big cities, Beijing and Shanghai, and got to talk to people. And it became clear to me that China is really a very powerful state when it comes to the development of really advanced technologies that are being used by the military to catch up to the United States. In China, the level of industrial development is phenomenal. You go into any of their big cities and the way they are able to transform what were previously kind of like third world urban centers into these kind of modern urban metropolises is really amazing. But what's even more amazing is the kind of resources and the know-how that has been given to the People's Liberation Army in developing any kind of military application technology that exists. And when it comes to secret space programs, I mean, they're very interested in that because the Chinese understand, as well as American defense strategists, that the next war, the next major war, if there is going to be one between major powers, will be fought in space because that's the strategic high ground. And anyone who's done any kind of military training knows that the most important goal in any military campaign is to first identify and capture the high ground, and space is the high ground.
They say the father of our U.S. space program was the German Wernher von Braun. Who might be his equivalent in China?
Well, that is a really important question. Werner von Braun was obviously a critical figure in Germany as well as the United States. What we have in China is someone who played a similar role to von Braun, and his name is Dr. Xian Shu Shen. And there are different spellings for that, but that's basically the pronunciation using my...
No one will ever doubt your pronunciation, Michael.
Well, you know, the best of Dundee training, so I got the Chinese down. Crocodile Dundee.
Is he still alive?
No, he died in around 2008, and he died in his, I think it was around 94, and he basically kickstarted the entire Chinese space program. Beginning in 1956, he established their first technical academy. It was called the Fifth Academy. And under the Fifth Academy, he was the director of that. He basically began the program to develop China's first rockets. And they were called the Dongfeng series of rockets. And they eventually became used for China's nuclear ballistic missile program. So that was, you know, an incredible accomplishment, given China in the 1950s was largely an agrarian society. And in the 1960s, they suffered with the Great Leap Forward, which was a ruinous agrarian policy implemented by Mao Zedong. But in the midst of all of this, Dr. Shen, he established this ballistic missile program using some of the help provided by the Russians and some of the old Nazi V-2 rockets as models. He was able to build Chinese variants called the Dongfeng series, and over the succeeding decades was able to increase their range and their yield and so forth. So they became the backbone of China's ballistic missile program. So he's widely credited for that accomplishment. But then there's also his work in developing the rockets for China's space program called the Long March series of rockets that began in the 1970s, sending up the first Chinese satellite. And China's been active in space ever since, with really Dr. Shen being widely acknowledged as the father of China's space program that we recognize today in terms of satellites being sent up by Long March rockets. And of course, you know, more recently, you've got lunar probes and you've got lunar landers. All of that can be traced back to Dr. Shen's pioneering work with the Fifth Academy. And the modern-day spin-off of the Fifth Academy, which is the China Aerospace Science and Technology Corporation, whose acronym is CASC, which basically is the company in China. It's a huge company in China that builds all of the rockets and spacecraft and does all the R&D. It's kind of like a Lockheed Martin and a Northrop Grumman combined.
Probably state-owned, though, I would guess.
Definitely, yes. State-owned enterprise. Employs well over 100,000 individuals, and it closely works with the PLA.
Now, who was responsible for training this doctor, who obviously must have gotten some studying from somebody?
Well, yeah, that is really fascinating because, you know, where did he get all of this knowledge to basically kickstart China's conventional space?
Yeah, race? Somebody trained the guy.
He was trained at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory at Caltech.
No way. We trained him?
It was Dr. Theodor von Karman, a Hungarian aerospace scientist who was a full professor at Caltech. And he accepted Xian Shu Shen as a PhD candidate and became his mentor. And as it turned out, eventually Dr. Shen's brilliance was such that Dr. von Karman basically fast-tracked Shen into the most secretive Army Air Force programs that were known to exist at the time.
Michael, we're going to take a quick break. We'll come back and talk more about your latest work, Rise of the Red Dragon. How far are they advancing, and how serious is it? Michael's website is exopolitics.org, linked up at coasttocoastam.com. We'll be taking your calls with him next hour here on Coast to Coast AM. So we will be right back with Dr. Michael Sala. And welcome back to Coast, Dr. Michael Sala with us as we're talking about his book, Rise of the Red Dragon. Michael, why in the world would we help out a communist nation with a space program?
Well, that goes back to the 1980s with Ronald Reagan, who was president from 1981 to 1989. He received a briefing, and he truly believed that the United States and other major countries in the world needed to band together to defend the planet against an extraterrestrial invasion. That he received this briefing about hostile extraterrestrials, and whether anyone believes it or not, it's on the public record that Reagan did go to major geopolitical events and actually talked about the need for the major countries to come together to cooperate to deal with an alien invasion. And the most famous, of course, was his speech in 1987 at the United Nations.
Right. And I thought he was just saying that to just say that, but maybe there was some fact behind it.
He believed it. And the question is, well, why did he believe that the major powers on the planet needed to band together to defend against the hostile extraterrestrials? And that's when it comes to this alleged briefing that Reagan received in 1981. And it's quite controversial, but I think it did happen, that either he received a briefing, as this leaked document suggests, involving his CIA director, William Casey, or he received a briefing very similar to it. But nevertheless, he received a briefing, which then kind of casts light on different scientists and different reports about China cooperating with the United States at these very classified facilities. And some American scientists got very upset about this, especially one scientist, Boyd Bushman, who worked with Lockheed Martin, actually at the Skunk Works. He actually did say in an interview that he was very upset when he learned about Chinese scientists working at Area 51 alongside American scientists to understand these alien technologies. And that was all because Reagan truly believed that China needed to work with the United States to defend the planet against hostile extraterrestrials. But there was a deeper agenda here, which is that the people that briefed Reagan only gave him partial information.
Ah, just what they thought he needed to know, right?
Exactly. They just kind of dangled a carrot in front of him and knew that he would follow a particular direction and kind of get all these countries to cooperate to deal with a possible alien species that was hostile. But what the people that briefed Reagan wanted in return was access to China's secrets, China's long history of ancient technologies that have been recorded in various ancient scriptures. There are artifacts in China, and probably the most important for the secret government were China's pyramids. The China's pyramids, there are hundreds of them, and they are not mausoleums, even though the Chinese government will tell you that they're mausoleums that date to the second century BC and the tombs of the Qin and the Han emperors, that's nonsense. They are much, much older. There are reports that China's pyramids date all the way back to the Atlantean era. So just as you have in Egypt, where you have your ancient pyramids that date back thousands of years before conventional archaeologists are willing to admit, but then you also have man-made versions that are inferior. The same thing happened in China. We had some very ancient pyramids that are being covered up by the Chinese government. And then you have later ones that were kind of built by some of the Chinese emperors, and that's where the Chinese government kind of like obfuscates the true origins of their biggest pyramids, saying that they're all mausoleums, whereas in fact, while some Chinese emperors did build kind of pyramid-like mounds, they were never as big as the ones that date back to the Atlantean era.
Michael, let's talk a little bit about the U.S. Air Force's secret space program under Dr. Theodore Van Karman. How extensive was that program?
Well, that was really the beginning of the Air Force's secret space program. In 1944, as the Second World War was winding to an end, Theodore Van Karman was basically given a briefing by General Hap Arnold, who's the only five-star Army and Air Force general, who was the chief of the Army Air Force, as it was known at the time. And he basically wanted Van Karman to put together the most competent scientific team of experts that he could find who would study all of the advances in aeronautical science that had been discovered during the Second World War, and especially that were being developed in Germany, in Nazi Germany. Hap Arnold knew that the Germans had built flying saucers, that they had flying saucer prototypes under development, and this is a fact. That Germany was developing flying saucers for the war effort. Where the controversy lies.
Now, was that reverse technology, or was this something they were developing on their own?
Well, you know, that's also part of the debate. You know, was this just the work of certain scientific inventors, such as Otto Schumann and a few others, or was it because the Germans had gained access to some alien technologies? We do know that there was a flying saucer crash in 1933 in Italy. And that Mussolini and Hitler did reach an agreement, a technology exchange agreement, and they did cooperate in developing a secret space program that was reverse engineering these flying saucers. Italy and Germany were cooperating in that, and there are German and Italian scientists come forward to confirm that, yeah, there was a flying saucer program under development. Where all the controversy lies is how far did that development go? Was it just, you know, developing some prototypes and kind of like the Messerschmitt jet fighter that kind of like never really saw light of day, never really saw mass development for the war effort? Or did they successfully develop it and just take it into a remote location as the war was coming to an end to basically start off again, you know, from that remote location, Antarctica? That's where the debate is. But, you know, regardless of that debate, what is a fact is that Dr. Shen was part of this scientific group that Theodore Van Karman put together at the request of General Arnold to basically analyze all of the most advanced aeronautical technologies and know-how out there, and they were sent to Germany in 1945.
Was that Operation Lusty, Luftwaffe Science and Technology?
Exactly. That's the one.
See, I read your book, Michael.
Oh, good. You got the copy. Great.
Oh, absolutely.
Great. I'm glad you got that. Yeah, Operation Lusty, an amazing program where you basically had a team of different teams. There were two known teams. The team that went there to find all of the advanced aerospace technologies that the Germans had developed to ship back to the United States for study at places like Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And also you had a scientific team that went to interview all the German scientists, look at whatever technologies were there, to make assessments as to which scientists and which technologies could be taken back to the United States for study and reverse engineering. And Dr. Shen was the only non-US person in that scientific team. Now, Dr. Shen actually was interrogated Wernher von Braun. So there you have. In occupied Germany at that time, you had the future founder of the Chinese space program interrogating the German founder of their space program, who would then go on to help launch NASA's space program. So
Jeez.
It was really a unique thing that happened historically, and Dr. Shen was involved in all of that. And he basically went back, and he, along with the other scientists, helped Dr. von Karman develop a multi-decade-long blueprint for the development of a secret space program that the Air Force would build. And this was something that was fully funded by the Truman administration, using a lot of the book funding sources that the CIA was created to generate. And so that was how the Air Force secret space program began in soon after the end of the Second World War, when they brought all of this capture technology and all of these scientists to the United States to understand and then reverse engineer a secret space program using supersonic flying saucer craft. And Dr. Shen was a part of that from the inception.
Okay, so that's a fascinating move there. The fact that it was back in 1945, God knows what it would be like today in terms of that kind of a program.
Well, yeah. I mean, we kind of get an idea in terms of the reports circulating about what the Germans developed from the 40s. But we know that the United States, even though they began basically in 45, 46, in terms of starting their own secret space program, and von Karman and Chen were a part of that under a scientific committee that was organized by General Arnold for the Air Force that was then being created, and that was called the Scientific Advisory Board, and they basically looked at all of this technology that was brought out of Germany and all of the advances in aeronautical laboratories in the United States and around the world, and came up with a blueprint for how the U.S. Air Force could develop its own secret space program. And what we do know today is that what the Air Force began developing in the kind of mid to late 40s, it was only by the 1960s and 1970s that the Air Force began deploying some of their reverse-engineered craft, that they had finally succeeded, that there was a lot of problems that they experienced. But by the late 60s, 70s, the Air Force had succeeded in developing some of these prototypes. And by the late 70s, these were becoming operational in terms of different squadrons of anti-gravity craft that the Air Force had.
Now, tell us about Father Albert D. Orville from 1661. What happened there?
Well, he was one of the first people to travel to Tibet. And he, of course, was a missionary. He was a Jesuit. And while he was there, he saw a flying saucer. It was a very clear kind of disc-shaped craft that he saw, and he was kind of wondering about it. And there was a Tibetan Lama near him who basically told him that, yes, that is the craft that belongs to our friends from outer space, who come here and share some of their technologies, share their wisdom, and tell us about the need for developing spiritually so that one day we'll be equipped or kind of ethically evolved enough to be able to handle these advanced technologies, and they will then share some of their technology. So back in the 1600s, you have a case of extraterrestrial contact in Tibet, and that continues to the present day. In the book, there are instances where you actually have these stories that there is, I think it's called Lake Namso in Tibet, which is basically an interplanetary spaceport where you have visitors landing and sharing information and educating people that want to learn about the space philosophy or learn about the technologies. And interestingly, it is where George Adamski was taken as a youngster before the First World War. In the early 1900s, George Adamski, the famous
Venusian guy, the guy who talked about going to Venus all the time.
That's the one, yeah. He actually spent, I think it was 5 years in Tibet, when he turned 12 years old. He was taken to Tibet, and he spent 5 years, around 5 years, traveling and being taught all about the Tibetan philosophy. And it was basically identical to the Space Brothers philosophy. And he taught Tibetan Buddhist philosophy at Laguna Beach prior to him actually starting to put out the information about the Space Brothers in the 1950s. And all he did was he swapped out the words Tibetan with Space Brothers. And basically, the same thing, the same philosophy.
I am fascinated by your work with the 1970 joint Chinese-Soviet mission attack on a secret UFO base in Mongolia. Tell me about that, and why did we have a base in Mongolia?
Well, that is really a very important historical incident that most people are not aware of. A lot of conventional historians are aware that in the late 1960s, around 1969, the Chinese and the Russians faced off along the border region and had these skirmishes there, and there were rumors of full-scale war, but it never happened. Well, you know, the backstory to that was that the Russians and the Chinese were seeing a lot of flying saucers around there, along the border region, and each thought that the other had developed flying saucers, and that these saucers were basically reconnaissance craft that were being used to spy on the other's kind of military deployments and facilities and so forth. So, you know, both were very interested in finding out, you know, where the saucers were based, and they were traced to an area in Western Mongolia. And Mongolia is a kind of buffer state between China and Russia. And even though it was at the time under the Soviet sphere of influence, it was nevertheless something that historically was part of China. So both China and Russia, or the Soviet Union, were very concerned that this area in Western Mongolia might be used by the other side as a base for conducting surveillance and espionage. And
we, of course, were the other side, right?
Well, when it comes to who it was, it wasn't the U.S. That's the thing.
It was not. All right.
It was a base. It was a base in Western Mongolia that I believe, based on all of the research that I did, belonged to an inner Earth civilization. Shambhala, Agartha, those are the terms that are often used for it. Both the Soviets and the Chinese were aware of the legends of Shambhala, that there's an underground civilization that dates back many millennia under the Gobi Desert. And so so there have been actually scientific expeditions to find Shambhala. This is a part of, again, the historical record that the Soviets, we know the Soviets did fund expeditions to find Shambhala. And so both the Chinese and the Russians were aware of these legends. And of course, when they saw all these flying saucers flying out of this base out of Western Mongolia, they attacked. And the Russians used tactical nuclear weapons to destroy the base.
My God.
And only a few days later, the Chinese also arrived there. And somehow the Chinese and the Russians, you know, whether they had military battles there or whether they just plundered, you know, the facilities at this base, nevertheless, I think this is where China basically got some of the hardware for its own secret space program. So, you know, whereas the United States had a whole series of flying saucer crashes, Cape Girardeau, Los Angeles, and of course Roswell and Aztec and so forth, in China.
Hold on, Michael. We're at the top of the hour. We'll come back and pick it up here. Plus, we'll take some phone calls with you next. Michael Sala with us, Rise of the Red Dragon.